Welcome back to In the Moment. I'm Lori Walsh. We kick off the hour with the Dakota Political Junkies. Joining me today, Jonathan Ellis. He's a reporter columnist for the Sioux Falls Argus Leader. Jonathan, welcome. Thanks for being here.
Happy to be here, Lori.
Also with us on the phone from Watertown, Roger Whittle, Watertown Public Opinion Managing Editor. Roger, thanks for being here as well.
My pleasure.
So Governor Kristi Noem gives her first budget address today at 1 p.m. Central, noon Mountain. We're going to carry that on SD.net so everyone can tune in. So lots to anticipate, lots to talk about, but I want to start with some of the other news coming out of the State House. And Jonathan, let's kick it off with you because you recently wrote about a lawsuit against the South Dakota House of Representatives Speaker and what's going on there.
Well, yeah, this happened late yesterday, actually, this lawsuit that was filed by Yvonne Taylor, who's been the longtime executive director of the South Dakota Municipal League, which is one of the sort of bigger entities that lobbies at the Capitol. And she has been barred from the House floor by the House Speaker, Steve Halgard. And apparently she contends in her lawsuit that she wrote a column in the Municipal Magazine in May saying that there were too many, quote, wackies in the legislature and that he took offense to that and has banned her from the floor. And she's claiming that this is a First Amendment retaliation by the House Speaker. And it's interesting. I mean, the House floor is, you know, having covered the legislature, you typically have the public has access to lawmakers when, you know, when they're not in session, when they're at their desks, and so to actually ban one person is an interesting move, and one that one probably could have predicted would have led to a lawsuit, and certainly now it has.
All right. So, and why is it important to give us an idea? You know, there's no office necessarily that for most lawmakers, you can't necessarily go. They don't have office hours. That's it. It's when they're on the House floor.
Yeah, they don't have office hours. They don't have offices. So typically for an organization like the Municipal League, they obviously have a lot of interest in various pieces of legislation. You know, that's an opportunity for her. If she had access to the House floor to talk to lawmakers about concerns that, you know, maybe they have with a bill, or you know, to try to, you know, get sponsors to sign on to bills that the Municipal League is trying to advance in the legislature. So without access to the floor, she's, I would imagine, fairly limited in her ability to actually communicate one-on-one with House members.
Jonathan, what is Stephen Halgard, Speaker Halgard, saying about why she was banned? Is he saying it was because of the column that she wrote? Does he have a different talking point about why she's banned?
He didn't return my call. I left a message with him on his cell phone last night, and I have not heard back from him.
Mm-hmm. Roger, any thoughts on this whole notion of keeping one person off of the floor? I haven't heard of this before.
I have not either, and it goes beyond just one person. This is a freedom of the press and a freedom of speech issue, because she expressed her opinion in her organization's publication. There's a government employee retaliating against her, and that just on the surface seems wholly inappropriate. Mm.
Jonathan, it's interesting because she's represented by David Lust, who also has some experience in the State House.
Isn't that funny?
Yeah, how'd that happen?
Yeah, that's an interesting deal there. Yeah, David Lust was the House majority, the Republican majority leader at one time, and he's actually served in the legislature with Representative Halgard. So that's kind of an interesting mix. Both David Lust and you know, would be probably considered a pretty, you know, conservative guy, and certainly Speaker Halgard is too. So that'll be kind of fun how this plays out a little bit.
Fun and funny. I'm not sure that.
Right.
It'll be interesting to watch. Right. All right.
And, yes, it will be.
And a lot at stake, really, if she loses at this point, because as Roger alluded to, if one person can be kept out, you know, for something that they wrote in the paper or in a newsletter or in public, who else can be kept out for something, for a criticism that they levied?
Well, and then other state houses have different rules. I mean, I covered the state house in Colorado, and so they had different. The public didn't have as much access necessarily, and so they just make a broad rule that fine, we're just going to ban the public, or we're going to have specific out. They could do other things to make life hard.
Interesting. Let's talk about some of the bills that are sort of popping up right now. And Roger, in today's, I'm not sure if it was today's public opinion or yesterday's, but City Council is looking at Senate Bill 66, which has to do with electric utilities. Break this down for us. Why is it so controversial?
It sounds like a very dry, boring topic, but it's really important for not only Watertown and other cities that have municipal utilities, but for the state in general. Here's what the deal is right now. There are 35 municipal utilities in South Dakota, and Watertown has one of them. And as Watertown expands and grows, the municipal utilities can expand with that and serve the new areas of town. Before the expansion, those areas were served by rural electrical co-ops. And now the rural electrical co-ops are saying that it's unfair that the municipal utilities can just take their territory with no due process. And so they filed a bill has been filed on their behalf to change this law to say that they would freeze all the areas right now. So even if Watertown would grow, the new areas of Watertown would be served by the existing rural electrical cooperatives.
There's a lot at stake right there, right? When you think about that, as the town of Watertown expands. Yeah.
And from Watertown's standpoint, Watertown right now has the lowest electrical rates in the state. Every survey that comes out shows that. And the city uses that as an economic development tool to attract businesses and industries to Watertown, where they can pay up to 30, 40, 50% lower utility bills than they would in other places. Watertown officials fear that if this bill is passed, they lose that advantage and would be very harmful to our economic development. And it goes beyond that. If companies are looking to move to cities where they can have low electrical bills, but now they can't, they will not stay anywhere in South Dakota. They'll go into North Dakota or Minnesota or some other place. So there's a lot at stake here, and it's really an uphill battle for the municipal utilities to fight this off, because there are only about 60,000 people, I think, in South Dakota are served by municipal utilities, and the other 600,000, 700,000 in the state are served by rural electric cooperatives. So they have a lot of lobbying power, and it's going to be a difficult thing to beat back for municipal utilities.
Is there a precedent, Roger, or what do you know about any precedent in other cities that have expanded and grown in the state?
I have not heard of any other problems. In fact, you have heard of no other problems with Watertown now until in the past couple of years there's been a few. But other cities that have them, like Brookings, Pierre, Madison, Vermilion, it would be interesting to find out if they have had any problems with this before. Rural electrical cooperatives saying that they already run on very small profit margins, and every time you take area away from them, it does significant damage to them.
And then likewise, it sets this bill could set a precedent for what happens in other cities across the state. So it really impacts a lot more than the Watertown area as well.
Oh, sure. It impacts all 35 of those municipal utility entities. So
what kind of conversation was happening at the city council is what I'm wondering. Like, what were some of the things that city council people were saying?
Well, the council is saying that this is an important economic development issue, not only for Watertown, but I say for the entire state. And, we've always enjoyed low-cost utilities here, and they don't want to see that change. So, of course, our city council mayor are totally opposed to the bill, but I think they also realize what they're up against here.
Right. And Jonathan, to Roger's point about sometimes the bills that seem a little boring or fly under the radar a little bit being significant, there's something there to talk about, isn't there?
Oh, yeah, for sure. I mean, these are the public policy bills that that we send lawmakers to peer. This is kind of the where they're earning their keep in a lot of ways. And, I guess who would probably want to be on the House floor lobbying on this bill? Yvonne Taylor.
Oh, that I see what you did there. Yeah, I didn't see that coming, and then you made that connection. Thank you. Wow. All right. So
that's why he's the best.
Yep.
Exactly. Oh, right. Hey, so yeah, no, Sioux Falls has a municipal utility as well. I mean, we're one of those 35. It's a very limited, but yeah, I mean, I don't think have the issue that Roger describes, but you know, it is an interesting issue.
All right. Speaking of some of those things, when we get into the details, Governor Noem's first budget address is coming up here this afternoon. You know, her State of the State address was sort of lauded as different than Governor Dugard. What do we expect, Jonathan, from her state or her budget proposal? Do we expect something different, a departure from the Dugard administration?
Yeah, I mean, the Dugard, he proposed, you know, some modest increases. It was a pretty meat and potato budget by design, knowing that, you know, future Governor Noem would probably want to have some ideas of her own, so that it's not surprising that, you know, she probably has some areas where she wants to emphasize. You know, in her State of the State address, I think she's talked about increasing like pheasant habitat, which would be interesting. How creative can the state be on that? Because a lot of that is sort of driven by federal policy. So, you know, I'm kind of curious where she's going there with that. As a pheasant hunter, kind of curious where she's going with that. You know, there's still the issues with methamphetamine and, you know, nursing homes. We're seeing nursing homes are kind of reaching in some areas of the state kind of a crisis. And so what is she going to propose potentially, you know, boosting their Medicaid reimbursement? A lot of the people in nursing homes are financed via Medicaid, and we've been told over the years that those reimbursements just are not keeping up with the actual cost of services. So, you know, it'll be interesting to see what she comes up with. I mean, you know, mental health, you know, there's just plenty of needs in the state. And so where do you kind of, how do you rejuggle the deck a little bit and see where you can put money, because she's, you know, she's pledged not to raise taxes.
Right. And Roger, that idea of nursing home, underfunding of nursing homes and that being a crisis, that was something that, you know, lawmakers were saying that they were expecting to hear something about in the State of the State, and they didn't. And now she's saying, you know, that, yes, this will be a part of the budget address as well. So lots of people anticipating the direction she might want to go regarding nursing homes.
Right. I think there's a serious problem out there, and I think we've had some nursing homes have already closed, and a lot of others are on the verge of closing. And when you, in small rural areas, I mean, people want their family members, their elderly family members, to be close. And if the local nursing home closes, then they're really up a creek with a lot of problems. So it's going to be interesting to find out how she's going to come up with a plan to stave this problem off. Right now, South Dakota reimburses the lowest level in the area, and I think it was something like half of what North Dakota reimburses for nursing home stays. So we're talking about a significant amount of money, and in a state that already prides itself on a very conservative budget, it's going to be fun to see where they're going to find this kind of money.
Right. And as Jonathan mentioned about mental health, I mean, this was an interim study that was done, folks gathered, and we were over the summer, we were talking, you know, nothing but mental health, it seemed, for a long time. Has that dropped off the radar of Governor Noem? Are lawmakers talking about mental health in the same way that they were, that they put all this effort into? Roger?
Well, that's a good question. I know you're right, it was a big topic in the summer, but I think, you know, people move on to new topics seem to come up every so often, and the old ones just kind of fade away. But I think you'll probably see some kind of effort to improve our mental health care in this state.
Yeah. Jonathan, thoughts on that? Or?
Yeah, I mean, I think, look, this is a state that's run by pretty conservative Republicans. And in the wake of some high-profile school shootings where clearly the perpetrators had some mental health problems, conservative Republicans have responded by saying, oh, we need additional mental health, you know, screening or whatever. Well, I mean, at some point you got to kind of make good on how that's going to happen. And you know, if you're not going to, you know, that's their solution to a fairly profound policy issue, then let's see it. You know what I mean? And again, a lot of this is a national issue, but you know, what can be done at the state level? You know, if that's your solution, where is it? You know. So I would hope to see, you know, some additional resources.
Right. And not to make too interesting a transition or segue, but let's talk about concealed carry legislation, because there are lawmakers who would say, when you talk about shootings in places where guns should never be, the answer is more people being allowed to carry guns, not fewer. So where are we at with permitless carry bills, Roger? How is that shaping up this session?
Well, I believe one has already passed the Senate, is on its way to the House. Senator Brock Greenfield from Clark introduced it. And it's pretty straightforward. Just anybody can carry a concealed weapon. You don't have to go through the sheriff now to get your permit. And even though the Sheriff's Association and the State's Attorney's Association both oppose this bill, I believe it passed fairly easily in the Senate. And I think Governor Noem has indicated that she supports this kind of constitutional carry, as it's called. So I think a lot of the lawmakers have been emboldened to either bring forth these bills or to vote for them.
Jonathan, the South Dakota Sheriff's Association and State's Attorney's Association opposed the bill. I checked with the South Dakota Fraternal Order of Police this morning, and they have not issued an official policy on how they feel about Senate Bill 47. Your thoughts, Jonathan, on the timing of this? It has failed in the past for a variety of reasons. Does it have more legs this time?
Well, as Roger pointed out, I mean, Kristi Noem ran on this as it was one of the things she said she would do. She would sign it. She was, you know, very, very blunt about that. So keep in mind that it did pass. Governor Dugard listened to the concerns of law enforcement and decided to veto the bill. But, you know, it's not no surprise that this thing is going to pass. And so South Dakota will join roughly about a dozen other states that have similar constitutional carry.
Other lawmakers speaking out, though, and Senator Lee Schoenbeck of Watertown said, "I'm sticking with my sheriff on this one. I'm gonna vote no because of the local sheriff." So, how much pull do sheriffs have? You know, Roger. You know, when we looked at the Attorney General race, it was all about, or when Marty Jackley ran for governor, it was all about the sheriffs and what they had to say, but not on this one.
Does that surprise you?
The obvious demands comment is what we're going for there.
Yes, exactly. I think people have their own feelings on things, and then will use whatever excuse they can to boost that.
Yeah.
So.
All right. Well, let's finish up by talking about civics education, because that's another interesting conversation, as new Secretary of Education for the state, Ben Jones, has brought forward this conversation about civics. Kristi Noem said in her State of the State that kids should have to pass a citizenship test to graduate from high school. We have Senator Jim Boland speaking out about the need for civics education. But it's a fairly complicated conversation. Jonathan, what do you see is at stake, or what are some of the nuances here that you think are worth mentioning?
Well, I mean, yeah, I'm a civics proponent, and I think most journalists probably are. You know, we want people to be educated and go out and be able to vote with, you know, clearly know what's going on. The requirement that would create a full year of civics is opposed by the people within the school associations. You know, they're concerned that, you know, they would have to reshuffle how kids would be able to, you know, get the credits they need to graduate. There would be concern that there's, you know, they would lose a chance to take an elective. There's concern that the legislature is doing this at all because they think it should be done through the State Board of Education, which has the expertise in this area of curriculum. But there's plenty of angst among the likes of the Secretary Ben Jones and Jim Boland and others who point out that you got these surveys that regularly show the majority of adults in this country can't pass basic civics tests. They don't know that there's three branches of government. They don't know very, you know, basic things. In the hearing on that bill, Senator Wayne Steinauer said that, you know, he goes, it's scary that what people don't know when he's out campaigning. So. Right. I think
but
that,
does
you know,
that
the
mean
governor,
that we didn't learn it, or does that mean we forgot it? Because I can pass that test, but if you give me a chemistry test, I'm not going to do very well because I don't use, you know, I'm not. So is that because it was not taught in high school? I mean, didn't we all have government or civics growing up? And
Well, yeah, that's some of the opponents of this say, hey, look, we already kind of have this built into the curriculum, starting even in kindergarten. You know,
right.
You heard testimony on that, and so that they say it's there, it's already in existence, and you know, so maybe you're right. I mean, if you're somebody who's interested in chemistry, and once you're out of high school, you still continue to read about chemistry, and maybe that's maybe. But you know, I recall in high school. Now I had 2 years of history classes in high school, and I don't think that that's part of the current curriculum in South Dakota.
Mm. Roger, is it the role of the state legislature to look at an issue like that and make it happen?
Well, I would generally say no. I mean, our legislators always say they're for local control and everything, and now they take this step to do something from the top down. Given that, I agree with what they're doing. I mean, I agree that we need more civics education. People have to learn more about how their government works. It's the only way we can have an informed electorate, which is the key to a successful democracy.
Right. And this is
but
one
I
of
also
the,
think
yeah.
that,
go ahead.
Go ahead. I also think we need better education across the board, not just in government, though.
All right. But, Roger, here's the interesting thing. When Secretary Ben Jones was on in the moment when I was in Pierre, one of the things that he spoke about so eloquently was, you know, we've been talking about STEM education. We've been talking about technical education. We don't want those, we don't want civics. We don't want history. We don't want, literature, the humanities to be pushed to the side. And as a college professor, he was saying, I can tell you it's been pushed to the side because of the students that I see come in. So is this part of a broader conversation, Roger, about, you know, what's happening with the tech schools and, apprenticeship programs and what is the nature of education? There's a lot at stake in this conversation if you broaden it that far.
Well, that's true. And I think the it should be broadened because, I mean, while we need technical education, we also need, scientists and we need doctors and lawyers and stuff. So, I just think that people like us who went to school years and years ago are just, much better educated than people today.
Okay. And there is a parent,
and
as a
my
parent.
Phone number is.
Oh, no, you don't have to call because as a parent of a 17-year-old, I can tell you this child knows more than I ever learned in high school. It's incredible the expectations that are placed on. And I don't know every school. I don't know every classroom. Obviously, but there's them's fighting words, Roger Whittle.
Yeah, they were said in jest.
All right, Dakota Political Junkies, Jonathan Ellis with the Sioux Falls Argus Leader and Roger Whittle with the Watertown Public Opinion. Roger, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Jonathan, thanks for being here.
Thanks again, Lori.